This is the Education Gadfly Show.
There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's Junior, the blah, blah, blah. Just you and me. Woo!
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the princess of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, Janie Skull.
I'm so honored.
Janie, is it fun reading about the princess?
It actually is. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you know, we might not be British, but it's still exciting and just another princess. And I don't know. I mean, it's depressing on the level that, you know, my hopes for being Prince William's choice are dashed. Yes. But, you know, at some point we have to let go. I know.
You know, I have a little bit of memories of Princess Di's wedding way back when. Do you remember? Do you know, anybody know what year that was? I mean, in the 80s.
It was in the 80s, right? Yeah.
So I think I was some sort of kid or adolescent. And I remember it being impressive that you look back on those pictures and you just think, what were they thinking? Hairstyle-wise, everything else.
But everyone loved Princess Diana.
I know.
Even with her short haircut.
Yeah, I know. All very tragic. And the fact that he gave his new bride her ring.
Yeah,
very touching.
Very beautiful ring. Definitely.
So, Janie, you know, we have a new coffee machine here at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute.
Yes,
it's making me feel a little kinetic here today. I think I'm...
you're a little hyped up, Mike.
I'm a little hyped up. Can you tell?
Can't get enough of it.
So, I tell you, I don't like to drink coffee with caffeine, I have to admit. I like the decaffeinated version, but this new fancy coffee machine that we have, that I have to admit I'm pretty excited about, does not have many decaf options.
So it's so fancy that you can only get caffeinated?
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Exactly. Some kind of conspiracy theory. So anyways, we're going to go warp speed today, thanks to my caffeinated state. So lots to cover from what happened over the holidays. We've been away for a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. Let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Question number one. After weeks of hoopla and hullabaloo, Kathy Black is officially New York City's school chief. Did David Steiner make the right call in giving her a waiver to become Gotham's next school chancellor?
If I had to say so, I would say yes. I think that, you know, you don't necessarily need the school credentials to do this job. It takes a lot of actual management skills, and that, yes, he did. Even though I think the advisory panel kind of didn't support her selection, I think he probably made the right choice. And I think the important part is what a lot of people are talking about right now, that they named the second in chief to be, what is his name? It's Shale Polaksky something.
That name made no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, there's a lot of letters in it. But, I mean, he sounds like he'll be a really good guy, and everything I've heard about him so far is very positive. So I think together they will hopefully be a good team.
Yeah, look, you know, I agree. Checkerfin had a piece last week saying that this was a decision that David Steiner shouldn't even have to make. I mean, it's kind of silly to say we're going to have mayoral control, but then we're going to keep in place this process where you have to waive these credentials. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should just kill the whole credential system and say, hey, do you have what it takes to do the job or not? Now, I don't know that she has what it takes to do the job or not.
Definitely.
And I think that the mayor has done a very poor job of communicating why she in particular has the skills for the challenges New York faces at this time. And clearly she's been an effective manager, led large organizations, you know, has a track record of success. So that's all good. Could have used a little more about how that's she's going to be able to apply that to the education system.
Definitely.
As far as like making her team up, I mean, I think... was it Andy Rotherham may have said, and said this right, that, you know, if David Steiner actually thought he had to tell Kathy Black that she should hire, you know, somebody as her deputy who knew something about schools, like, that does not, you know, bear well on what he thought of Kathy Black. But look, I think David Steiner didn't want to have to make this decision. You know, he did stand up on principle before he backed down out of realpolitik.
But I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of potential. You know, it might not be the best choice. We'll see. You know, only time can tell. But I think that there's no evidence right now that this is necessarily a bad choice. So I think we'll see where it goes.
Look, with her background in publishing, I think at the least we can expect that, you know, information going home to parents should be much better produced,
exactly.
Slicker, better pictures and things. I think maybe newspaper clubs at the high schools are going to be a lot better. Watch out for that.
Sounds good.
Okay, topic number two.
Mike. You recently published a riveting article in Education Next on differentiated instruction.
Riveting.
Oh, thank
riveting.
You. Riveting. Riveting. Thank
it
you.
Was.
Did I write that?
Is it possible for one teacher to instruct high and low achieving kids in the same class and do it well?
It's really, really hard. So, this article, Education Next, all together now, you can check it out. talks about differentiated instruction. You know, the buzzword going around that says, okay, if you are a teacher and you've got kids of all different levels in your classroom, which you likely do, partly because of mainstreaming and special ed, partly because of the move away from ability grouping and away from tracking, you've probably got kids who might, you know, some kids who might be a couple years behind, other kids who might be a couple years ahead, and you got to try to teach them all. Some would say it's impossible. Ed schools say, well, you just have to differentiate instruction, find ways to target your instruction differently. I went in and looked at a school that's trying to do this. I looked at all the research. And bottom line is, I mean, you got to be pretty amazing teacher to pull this off with. You got to have all kinds of support and resources. So it's the kind of thing that can be done in the best of all circumstances. And even then, it's hard and it's imperfect. I think it is not something that we can bank on for the vast majority of America's schools. And we got to be willing to say, look, there's going to be time when it makes sense to group kids by ability.
But I think on some level, it does make sense that we need to figure out whether we're separating kids into groups or not, how to meet the needs of every single kid. I mean, I always remember someone saying once that the problem with special education are problems in general education, that we're just not meeting what each individual kid needs because it's very hard to do in a public school. So yes, it's, you know, near impossible to do, but I can't help but get, you know, excited about things like School of One, that actually the whole idea is to use technology to kind of cater entire instruction to, you know, individual students and break them up during the day. And sometimes they're at computers, sometimes they're with teachers, sometimes they're in groups, sometimes they're not. I just think there's a lot of potential there. And if differentiated instruction is going to go anywhere, I think it's in the direction of using technology.
Yeah, and what's interesting about School of One is that what they spend a lot of time doing, what the kids spend a lot of time doing when they're not on the computer, is they are in groups. And mm-hmm. those groups are largely based on where they are, you know, ability level wise at that moment. And so I think that, you know, we can't get away from this basic fact that it does not make a lot of sense to try to teach kids who are all over the map academically, teach them in the same yeah. classroom exactly. without any, you know, it just doesn't work. Gets tricky because when you start to group by academic level, sometimes depending on the school, that means you start to group by racial or ethnic group or socioeconomic group as well. And that's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's really a struggle. But you can check it out and read the 20 plus comments or the 35 plus tweets on the article so far. Okay, back to you, Daniela.
Question number 3. Tea Party groups are planning to run candidates for local school boards and are scrutinizing school budgets. A promising development?
I love it. I think this is very promising. Look, I've been skeptical about the Tea Party folks on many fronts, but I think this is a great role for them to play. This mm-hmm. is where the money gets spent. The decisions are made, and most school districts haven't had enough of sort of taxpayer groups or citizen groups looking over their shoulders at school boards and administrators.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, scrutinizing school budgets aside, just anyone who's creating, you know, an organization or a group of people to check the power of unions in normal school board elections, because a lot of times it's, you know, the union gets all the teachers to come out, and the people who end up getting elected are people who are most likely supported by teachers' unions. So to have any sort of check on that, any sort of, you know, counterbalancing force, I think is a general improvement, you know? Yeah. I'm not necessarily backing either side, but just to have at least competing ideas and not just one idea, you know, yeah. directing the entire district.
Now, what I suspect is going to happen is that they're going to discover that a lot of the things that they'd like to do to reduce spending at the local level, they can't do because yeah. of state laws and policies. And they're going to start to have some empathy for local superintendents, some of whom want to do the right thing and make some tough cuts and can't. They're going to find out in some states, for example, that last hired, first fired is state law, or that states mandate a single salary schedule with steps and lanes, or that they mandate a certain number of sick leave days, and on and on and on down the list. And they start to understand why schools do things like just raise class size across the board and let go of the youngest teachers and get rid of art and music. So I think the trick is going to be harnessing that energy at the local level to then help push for changes at the state level, which is where a lot of this stuff has to get fought out.
Yeah, and I think the whole idea behind it that, you know, these groups have the most chance to actually affect something in, you know, their localities, in their states, is very true. You know, they don't have the time to come to Washington and try to change things, you know, in Washington, from Washington. I think it's probably the right place for them to be trying to, you know, actually being grassroots organizations and functioning in their locales. So,
all right. I'm more of a cappuccino party kind of guy myself. Thank you, Daniela. That's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Next up, we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show. How was your Thanksgiving?
Thank you, Mike. I had two Thanksgivings, two big fat turkeys, two big fat hams, and no workouts. So not good.
I'm so jealous. I'm always trying to figure out a way to score at least two Thanksgiving dinners.
Thursday night and Friday night.
That's awesome. Did you have any fried turkey?
No fried turkey this year. No, but it was very good. My aunt made the turkey at my first Thanksgiving. My uncle at the second. So they're not together anymore, as you can imagine. But anywho, it just means we get two Thanksgivings.
And people say that there's no upside of divorce. Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
So we have the new report out by McKinsey & Company that examines how the world's most improved school systems keep improving. It is a fascinating report. It uses both quantitative and qualitative methods to identify 20 systems around the world, all with improving but differing levels of performance. So the researchers looked at international tests and other system-level assessments. They normed the data onto a common scale, and they categorize the systems into four improvement journeys: poor to fair, fair to good, good to great, great to excellent. Lots of different systems here, including Boston, Hong Kong, Western Cape, South Africa, Armenia, and Ghana. So lots of diversity here. They interviewed over 200 individuals. They analyzed 600 interventions, so a pretty impressive database. Findings. First, they found that the vast majority of interventions in improving systems are process in nature, meaning not having to do with organization, governance, or resources, but rather with improving how instruction is delivered. So these systems are really getting into the nuts and bolts. They also found that each stage of the school improvement process is associated with a particular cluster of interventions. So this was also interesting. So systems that move from fair to good status focus on establishing the foundation for data gathering and being transparent about school results. For instance, while schools moving from good to great concentrate on the teaching profession, such that its practices are clearly defined. Systems in poor to fair improvement category tend to have a central authority that scripts instructional practices for teachers, but in the upper improvement categories, they tend to increase the responsibilities of school leaders to shape instruction. So it goes on and on, kind of giving these really fascinating categories and how the different interventions evolve across the categories. Finally, the last finding, the most common event to spark reform in all of these 20 improving systems around the world was a leadership change. So I don't think that's too surprising.
A leadership change on what level? School level?
It said it could be political or strategic. So it could be, a higher sort of, policymaker type appointment or otherwise. So yeah, it was neat. I appreciated, McKinsey's great for getting into the black box. There's been plenty of reports about, how do we improve schools? But this is global, so it's really interesting. And the sort of efforts they went to classify these schools, it's empirically based in terms of looking at the, where they went above or below the standard deviation, the mean, and how they categorize them. And then interviewing, 200 people, 600 interventions. It was a lot of work. And I think it really shows some interesting nuances in terms of how we think about how systems move along the continuum to improve.
So people complain sometimes that McKinsey and some of the other consulting firms that they'll play fast and loose with the data and the research. Mm-hmm. I would think a Russ Whitehurst might look at this and say, well, these aren't random assignment studies, or these are, you're drawing, these conclusions from things that are just correlational. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think this is a different type of study. I think it's more of it in the black box. And I don't think, and Rick said this before, there are certain study designs that lend themselves to mm-hmm. questions. And this one isn't about what is the impact of an intervention. It's not an impact study.
Yeah.
It's more of a in the black box study. And I think the way that they went about identifying the school systems and categorizing all the different things they did, mm-hmm. And trying to make sense of it, I think it fit for this type of study.
Yeah. And I also, it's very interesting that they said that the governance and sort of institutional arrangement stuff didn't matter that much. Mm-hmm. Although it does seem like they focused on systems that were themselves sort of running the schools.
Right.
So in other words, it's not to say that, if you're trying to improve U.S. education, which isn't mm-hmm. a system, but a collection of 16,000 systems or even a state system, which is really a collection of hundreds of systems, you know, you still at that level probably have some governance and institutional arrangement challenges.
Right. And I think that's where it got a little sticky, because they had to use a pretty broad sort of way to define a system. You know, when you look at Boston and Hong Kong, you know, I mean, both are a system. So, I mean, I think they gave themselves
some leisure there.
Right?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. Hong Kong might be.
Yeah. Well, Singapore was in there, too.
Singapore. I mean, but these, you know,
some small
city
states. Yeah. Right.
Well, did they look at any that did not improve to see if these interventions were things that other, you know, other systems were not doing, or is it?
No, it was pretty. I mean, some of them were small. I mean, they had a, you know, a poor to improving was their lowest category. So they were had to demonstrate some gains.
Yeah, because I would be interested to see if I would think that in most systems anywhere, there's something that's changing all the time.
Right.
So I'd be interested to see if any of these are, you know, negatively correlated to improvement, or if, you know, it's just kind of coincidental that some of these are doing the same thing as systems that aren't improving.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's a fair question. They do go into quite a bit of detail at why they sort of how they categorize the interventions. And I think that's important, you know, in terms of, you know, what are you calling a blob? I mean, it's just kind of it gets kind of complicated in terms of how they did the mapping. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the sort of in the weeds questions that people who are really interested in digging in need to look at, you know, because how you code an intervention has much to do with how your results come out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is the song that goes along
with this? So the song
is,
since we're discussing change around the world in education, we have the charitable song from 1985, We Are the World by USA for Africa.
Yes.
We're done and out, and there seems no hope at all. But if you just
make a brighter day. So let's start giving. There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true, get the blah, blah, blah. Just you and me.
Woo!
Can we just have that and not the actual song?
Yeah, this is,
that will be the beginning.
You know, it's like mid-80s day around here at the Gadfly Show. First Princess Di's wedding, and now we are the world. I love it. I love it. All right. Well, it is everyone's new favorite segment. It is Chris with What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that? What's up with that? Yes, sir.
Okay, Chris, so what you got for us this week?
All right. Imagine this. It's a warm and sunny fall Saturday morning in Maryland. One could not ask for better weather for little Nico's first soccer game. Being the good dad that he is, Mike arrives for the game on time and ready, supporting Nico and his teammates by shouting and cheering from the sidelines.
Go, Nico!
Prior to kickoff, though, Nico's coach calls all the parents over to inform them that the only ones allowed to make any noise during the game are the players on the field.
What?
Meaning Mike and the rest of the parents have to remain dead silent for the entirety of the game.
Wait, the parents of the children on the field?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
And everyone else, for that matter, that's not playing in the game.
Gotcha.
Sounds insane, doesn't it? Believe it or not, this silent game policy is growing quite popular in the Bay Area and other areas of the country as well. I could not be more in favor of youth athletics as a means of teaching children about teamwork, integrity, and fair play. But forced sportsmanship policies such as these are doing nothing but setting false expectations for the real world and effectively making kids soft. It started with giving every player a trophy at the end of the season. It got worse when junior sports leagues decided to stop keeping score. The line needs to be drawn somewhere, and I'm drawing it here. While I would never advocate poor sportsmanship, these policies are robbing young players of some of the not-so-fun but ever-so-important life lessons that are learned through playing sports. As Mike and Janie can certainly attest, the entire world will not always be in your corner. In fact, earmuffs for any little children out there listening, sometimes there will actually be people cheering against you. So before we go telling parents to stop cheering because it might hurt some kids' feelings, let's think a little more big picture about what these policies are really teaching our kids. Silent game athletics. What's up with that?
I mean, I feel like this doesn't even address the problem. The problem is that, you know, you have some parents who are really heckling kids and making them feel bad. But if you're still allowing some parents to, you know, be loud, I guess, and not others, you're not really fixing the problem. You're just making parents antagonistic towards each other and towards, you know, the rules.
Let's be clear though. What problem are they trying to solve here?
Well, there's a kind of a myriad of problems that they're trying to address. One is children being, they want the kids listening to their coach, and the kids will sometimes, you know, parents will yell out, do this, Johnny, kick it here, shoot, when the coach wants them to pass.
Okay.
So they want to get rid of that. They also want to get rid of parents obnoxiously cheering for their kids and making the other team feel bad.
Now, see, and I would think there's another piece, which is parents heckling the referees.
Well, yeah. Right. That's another element.
Or shouting obscenities at the referees, which I can imagine is a real problem.
I think that can be handled on a, you know, case-by-case basis.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is like, you know, the classic problem with zero tolerance policies of any sort, right? It says, well, it's too hard to make distinctions and, you know, to use judgment and to, you know, address people, you know, take action, for example, when a parent says something obnoxious and saying, well, you're not allowed to come back ever again. So instead, we'll just have these blanket policies. I mean, it's not making our kids soft. What it is, it's making our leaders soft, Chris. What's up with that?
Oh, I guess you got me there, Mike. But
all right, well, sorry. It's the extra coffee today. I just didn't mean to hijack your segment. It is sad. And by the way, silent games, I mean, that would mean that I can't bring Nico's brother, Leandro, because let me tell you, that kid's a year old. He's not going to be quiet. All right. Very good. Well, thanks for coming on. And Janie, thanks for hosting.
You're welcome.
Was fun. We're going to be here all throughout the month of December. So till next week.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show. You can always find us online at edexcellence.net. I'm signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.